seven donuts.
This is it.
We're gonna have to leave and come back, unfortunately.
Over the years.
I want to talk about one aspect of Hanukkah which is never highlighted enough. It was not highlighted in the Eastern European experience because it didn't resonate according to the reality of their life. So it was not significant or important enough to deal with. It didn't resonate in the 20th century because in the 20th century, unfortunately, the influences in the Jewish community have come from a lot more secular sources. And therefore, the thrust of Hanukkah that we look at is a very universalist notion of religious freedom, religious liberty, one that can that resonates very well in the Western world. But both the traditional classical focus on Hanukkah and the 20th century focus, both did not hone in on really what a major, major aspect of what Hanukkah is. And it is particularly important in the contemporary age to understand that. Hanukkah, of course, was the clash between Yovam and Klal Yisrael. But what's forgotten, the nature of that clash is what's forgotten. We think of Greece in terms of its avodah zarah, its culture, its art, all true. But there are pinpoints along the way. They don't get to the basic theme. They miss the theme. The issue of Hanukkah was the initial confrontation of Klal Yisrael with Western society. Greece is the age of reason. Man's life is dictated by his experience. Whether it's his intellectual experience, his emotional experience, but his experience. That's ultimately what's significant in life. And the thrust of reason in the world, science in the world. We have some of the early development of Western society, but significant development, mathematics, stems all the way from Euclid, all the way back. Geometry, study of astronomy. To begin in an intellectual sense to unravel the world around us. And on one hand, from the standpoint of Yahadus, it's a very appealing notion. Because the reality is that the antithesis of Avodah Zarah. Man does not live by myths, but rather by engaging and understanding the world around him. And the struggle that began in our confrontation with Yovam is one that would find a hiatus for a considerable period of time in the Jewish community. And certainly after the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, or certainly after the fall of Rome, it was not to play a significant role in the Jewish community for over 1,000 years. Because we were outside Western society in that period. Western society in the Middle Ages, in the Dark Ages, was not exactly Western society as we know it either. They also took a hiatus. But even as Western society begins again, in a significant sense, and takes up centuries later where it left off, but we stay outside it for a long time. But as we get closer and closer to the modern era, what resonates in the Western world are the voices that resonate in the Jewish world. The intellectual appeal, the scientific process, and even ultimately religious notions, but all from Western perspectives. The Reformation is a Western perspective of religion. It is to change what came from the early on in history, 1500 years before, religious notions, and to call for men's reason change of them. And what started in the 16th century in Germany is by the 17th century will resonate with the Jews as well. And it is not by coincidence that the reform movement in Judaism starts in Germany, but the seat of the Reformation. That's where it had its initial effect on the Jewish community. But as time goes on, it spreads. And ultimately, as we come to the New World, we're back in a full confrontation with Western values. And that's really the notion of Hanukkah. The notion of Hanukkah was not the fact that we are not people of who believe in reason. To the contrary, we believe very, very much in reason. But we believe there are limitations to reason, to that the reason can only bring men so far. And that is the ultimate clash between Western society in turn and between Yom and Klal Yisrael. Is reason an open-ended, unlimited possibility? Or it too is subject, it is as finite as every other aspect of the human existence. And our notion is that man's wisdom is finite, just the human being is finite. And there are things of the infinite which are beyond the scope of the human reason. That's the notion that we have. The Torah was very careful to give us chukim and mishpatim. Mishpatim we well understand. They're laws that every civilization has in some form or another. Right? There's a system of justice. And there are laws limiting murder, robbery. Every civilized society has laws in these areas. Whatever exactly the structure of the law is not significant to us in this regard, but every civilized society has these laws. Because everyone in the world realizes that you still have a notion of society is out there. But what's the necessity of us having chukim? What do we need a chukim for? Chukim, we believe that they have some reason. The Rabbeinu Shalom asked us to get involved in chukim for a reason, but that reason is not apparent to us. And the Torah did not explicitly state its reason. And I believe the notion of the chukim, the necessity of having chukim, stems from the fact it's worth it. Searching in Mefarshim in the beginning of Parshas Chukas. In this regard, Chukim is to establish for us the limits of the human of human reasoning. Human reasoning only brings us so far. There's a limit to it. If everything that we did was subject to reason, then ultimately, whom do we worship? The Rabbeinu Shalom or the human intellect? You stepped outside reason, you're out of here. We worship ourselves, not the Rabbeinu Shalom. Chukim established that there's a limit to how far we can go. Even Shlomo HaMelech experienced that. The Gemara says in Yoima that he said, Amarti Yach Komo, that I will fathom the notion of Poraduma. I will understand its divine purpose. But yet Shlomo HaMelech concluded at the end of his quest, not only did he not understand it, but it is something I'm very far and distant from. I have no notion of anything that comes, that begins to make it understandable. Sometimes in intellectual pursuits, we don't understand something fully. But we have some measure of hypothesis which suggests what it's about. We don't know exactly how to draw its parameters, how to exactly to formulate it. We have an idea. We were searching. And later maybe someone comes along and refines it further and establishes focus. But Shlomo HaMelech stating that I don't begin to understand in an intellectual sense where this belongs, what it is. It's totally out of my realm. So even a Shlomo HaMelech is reminded by the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, Ad Kan, you're the wisest, you're Chacham Mikol Adam. True. But Ad Kan, it only goes so far. The experience of Torah is also the same. The Ovoids worship the Rabbeinu Shel Olam mitoch Seichel. But after the Seichel, there was Nevuah. So it was a combination of human intellect and revelation. All this would have been. Torah itself, the Rambam articulates as the Chovas HaLevavos, we should engage the world intellectually. Understand Tzias Hashem in an intellectual sense. But that's in tandem with the fact that we have a Messiah. We received the Torah at Har Sinai. So we're not left merely to the human intellect to divine what this world is about. The Rabbeinu Shalom gave us Bereishis Bara Elokim Eitzah Shamayim V'Eitzah Aretz. We can search all we want. And according to the Rambam, it's a mitzvah to do so. But ultimately, we have Messiah. Because we recognize that the human intellect can only take us so far. And the Rambam himself writes that at the beginning of the Moreh Nevuchim. The Rambam says Emunah is not something that can be fully established and clearly established on an intellectual basis. It is V'horayah l'kach, the Rambam writes at the beginning of the Yad. Avraham Avinu, the Rambam in round numbers is 1,000 years back. Avraham Avinu in round numbers is 3,800 years ago. So from Avraham Avinu until the Rambam is approximately 2,800 years. Approximately. And what does the Rambam write? He says, from Avraham Avinu's time until mine, 3 millennia, they're still debating Matthias Hashem. So you see that you can't prove this fully. The Rambam writes in the beginning of the Moreh Nevuchim. There's no intellectual means by which we could absolutely establish Mitzvah Hashem. It doesn't exist. A person with a Lev Yosher can have insights, can feel it, can know it, but he cannot intellectually demonstrate it. In the full intellectual sense. So we combine, we state again in Amunah, reason is significant, it's to bring us so far, but ultimately is Messiah, revelation. This is the very notion of Torah. Ve'ilah mishpatim asher tosim lifneihem, but below lifnei are kois. We cannot go to a non-Jewish court. For what reason? In the Sivas, in Siman Chavav, the Shulchan Aruch, and Choshen Mishpat tells us. The problem with our codes is very simple. We have different notions of justice. The human being is supposed to enact justice in this world. All the laws that exist in society. the Rebbeinu Shel Olam enacted laws too. So we have a choice. If we choose the ones made by human beings, and what we're saying in effect is that the human notions of justice surpass the Rebbeinu Shel Olam's notions. What greater Chilul Hashem is that? Can there be than that? So therefore, Halacha dictates that we settle it according to the laws of the Torah, because the laws of the Torah are the Rebbeinu Shel Olam's Mishpat. That beyond any notion of Mishpat that we can understand. Beyond any notion of Mishpat that we can understand. It's the essence of Chanukah. The essence of Chanukah is Torah. Torah not only in the simple sense of just Kiyum HaMitzvos, which is true, but Torah in its most profound sense. The Menorah, interestingly, of all the things that could have been the basis for the Nes of Chanukah, could have been anything in the Beis HaMikdash. You want to defile the entire Beis HaMikdash. Could have been the Mizbeach. Could have been anything. It was Be'ach Azov. But it was the Menorah. Why? Not even Shulchan Apon. Because I wrote to the Hachkim as Yadra. If one wishes to become wise in Torah, he should face the Menorah and the Tefillah towards the southern side. The Menorah is the light of Torah. That's the essence of Chanukah, the essence of our answer to our interaction with Western society, is the very profound light of Torah. In its fullest sense. Yes, to engage the world with intellect and reason. But to engage the world, Alpi Torah, with the realization that there's something that surpasses intellect and reason. That's the essential message of Chanukah. And one that in our day and age resonates very, very strongly. Now, I wanted to focus on some of the halachas which pertain, that we, when we live in the diaspora, in the Jewish experience in the month of December. When I was 17 years old, I was an Eretz Yisrael for the first time learning. And I yet remember the excitement that I had when I came around onto Rehov Yafo on the two bus. And to go down the whole Rehov Yafo, and there were no seasonal lights hanging on the Rehov Yafo. This was an exciting experience that many, many, many years later, I haven't forgotten. Actually, to come to a place in the world to be freed of foreign influences, and to be in a Jewish place was just overwhelmingly joyful. Anu adayin leizachino. So we have to confront the world around us. And I want to come back again to the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Mem Ches. It's an entire siman, siman kuf mem ches, on the chagei ha'olilim, how a Jew should interact with non-Jewish festivals. At the very last tif of this siman, yesh oimrem, and this yesh oimrem is significant. It's a Tosfos. And others, Rosh, Sefer Truma, Rabbeinu Gershom. For us, Tosfos at the beginning of Masechet Avodah Zarah is the key. Yesh Oimrem Shein Kol Dvarim Elu Amurim Ela Ba'os Hazman. These were meant for the time of Chachmei HaMishnah, Chachmei HaGemara. Avo Bizman Hazeh Einu Bekiyim B'Tuv Alilim. And I want to focus a little bit more from the Tshuvas HaRivosh, what exactly this means. They are not so knowledgeable about the order of worship of the Avodah Zarah, the average person is not so into the Avodah Zarah. The peak of mutter losses, the losses imam b'yom chagam, one can do business with them even on the days of their festivals. Ula halvoisam, and to lend money to them, chol shor adorim, and almost all the things that are mentioned in this particular siman. So what changed? What changed from the time of Chachmei HaMishnah until the time of the Rishonim? Now, from our estimation, this was not the 21st century European religious perspective, which is almost non-existent in the European mainland today, any significant religious experience. We were dealing at a time when people from our standpoint would have appeared to have been highly religious people, long before the Reformation. Moving to any westernization in reality. So what exactly was it that the Rishonim felt differentiated them from their earlier forebears? And it's interesting, the Rivosh and Tshuva cite the following. Like the motion for you. The Kosu B'Sefer Atruma B'Shem Rashi. So the Rivosh is addressing the issue, how come there are Haterim in the days preceding a festival to do business with the non-Jews outside Eretz Yisrael, but on the day of the festival itself, there's no such heter. And yet, in the time of the Rishonim, it was common practice to do business with them even on those days, and to send presents to them in honor of the festival. The Kosu B'Sefer Atumah B'Shem Rashi Zal. The Hainu Taimah B'Shem De'idmo Lo Adite B'Avodas Kachavim Kulehai. They are not so attached to the Avodas Kachavim, Lo Avlei Amodit. And they don't go, if something good happens to them, they don't run down to the Avodah Zarah to start thanking their deity for it. That's the thing. Yeah, they go to worship, and they're religious people. But they're not such super maminim that if any good turn happens to them in life, they run down to the Avodah Zarah to offer a korban toida for it. That they don't do. That's what changed. Meaning that the edge, the cutting edge of commitment to the religion has waned over time. And they're committed, etc., but they're not so enthusiastic as the forebears were. And then he goes into the fact that nevertheless, even if there is substantial difference in the level of the religious observance. And in Rashi's time already, he felt that it was unlikely, just because he gave him a present, that he was going to run down to his local religious establishment and start pulling Kerem and Mishtachavim to his Getchka. Nevertheless, but it's a Dindarabonim. So a Dindarabonim, even we say Botla Taimele, Botla Gzeir. So the riot that Rashi brings is that this was never made as a fixed Gzeir. It was meant only to fit particular places and particular times. And where it didn't fit, it wasn't intended. How do I know this? The Eloi Hoch, Eloi Mashmul, the Vagoyle, and Amosra, Eloi Mchaga Bavad. Heich, Eloi Mashmul, the Vagoyle, and Amosra. The Gemara says 3 days before, the Mishnah said, before their festival, he's not allowed to do business with them. And Shmuel said that an outside Eretz Yisrael, this only applies on the day of the festival itself, not for 3 days before. So what would change from inside Eretz Yisrael to outside Eretz Yisrael? If it's a fixed zera, it's a fixed zera. So no difference could may have it to change the halacha. So how did Shmuel come to this conclusion? And then we find another story in the Gemara, Rochanami Muchav Kidamina Pirka Basra, Robo Shodar Korbono Lavasheshach Biyam Chaga. There was obviously some non-Jewish nobleman, and Robo sent him a present on one of the festivals, his festivals. Omar Kimli Begavei Deloit Tolach. I know, just, he's not going to run to bow down to his idol to thank him for receiving this present. It's not his style. But it was not made as a leit plug, universal. It was made according to each time and place. So the Rishonim already estimated that 1,000 years ago, they were not so fast, the average non-Jew, that when he, something good happened to him in his life, they go racing down, and the immediate response was to give Shevach Vaido to his deity. In Mamela, that's what changed. That's what they said. It's Midigo was saying, they're pious, they observe the religion, etc. But in a certain regard, it's more cultural than religious. Because we see when it comes to the ultimate religious value that the forebears had of constantly giving her daughter to the Rabbeinu Shalom, that they don't have. There was a person, it's a maimon, a full-fledged maimon. Everything that happens is Baruch Hashem. It's Makkah the Rabbeinu Shalom for everything. That's his immediate response. But for them to respond in such a way that they're going to run down in this worship to Rabbi Dezor to give thanks, Shevach Vaido, for it, that the Rishonim estimated was no longer taking place so regularly in their time already. Obviously, there must have been some very religious people, to that extent, super religious. So that's what they're saying now. We can extrapolate if 1,000 years ago, that's what the Rishonim felt, that certainly Allah's Kama V'Kama applies to our time. In our time, we have that the non-Jewish world complains that their festival is lost, it's religious, or it's become a commercial happening, right? A social celebration. That's their complaint about their day. So Allah's Kama V'Kama, the Shulchan Aruch statement, if somebody gets a present in today's world, the likelihood of his response being that he's going to go down and offer some type of prayer in his local establishment, his response to it is certainly far-fetched in today's world. So that's the basis that the Rishonim formulated for Ashkenazic Rishonim, obviously in particular, but the Tshuva is the Tshuva of the Rivosh, obviously affected the world of the Rivosh of the Sfardi. And the Mechaber and the Shulchan Aruch takes over. So this was a sea change from what took place in the Gemara to the time of the Rishonim. Now the Ramah continues, even if the money is given directly to the priests of their religion, normally, money which is given to their priests is not the type of gifts that a Jew might give them, were not given for worship objects directly. In other words, they don't buy the wine for the altar, for the service for it, nor do they buy things with which to beautify their religious edifice. But what are these funds used for? This is to support the parsonage, the basic needs of the religious establishment. That's what they use the money for. And this is a very, very principal reason. There is a question of arousing enmity of non-Jews. If we totally segregate ourselves and we assume an insular attitude towards them on the days of their festivals, we live together with them. This is all for the Torah. And we have to do business with them. We live side by side with them. Socially, we interact with them to some level. In business, we're engaged with them constantly. So it's going to arouse Ava if we just have totally ignored their festival. And I've mentioned that other times. I always found this fascinating. The Tor Shulchan Aruch lived in Spain for a big part of his life. The Rosh, because of the persecution of the Maram Rutenberg, He was also afraid that they want to imprison him, as the foremost disciple of the Maharam of Rutenberg. And he managed to escape from Germany to Spain. That's why he went to Spain, because Spain was outside the realm of where German power could be exerted. And he becomes a Rav in Toledo. The Rosh is a very seminal figure in the world of the Halacha, because he personally bridged the gap between the Ashkenazim and the Sfarim. He was Ashkenazi Rav who learned in Germany, and yet he was a Rav, a Sfaradish Rav, and a Sfaradish country, a Sfaradish Rishayim. And in Spain, certainly a very religious country. A very religious country. And that Spain of 1,000 years ago, he still felt this pshat is appropriate. The Maliyatay. So, on one hand, we have the license to extend our greetings to them, to give them presents, our good wishes. And it's an important yardstick in the halacha, which allows us to interact with the world around us. But the Shulchan Aruch then has a cautionary note. V'lachayim, on one hand, in nichnas le'er motim smeichem yem chagam, is yismach imon, show his enthusiasm, you know, wish them a happy holiday. Bisham eva, ta'abi kamachlus l'hochim, l'hem, it's as if one is flattering them. But when we call Moko, Bal Nefesh, Yarchik, Mimismayachim. A person that's pious will stay away from them to the extent possible from joining in their celebration. And if he's able to do it in a fashion which will not arouse resentment, so then he should shy away from it. And there's a Rishalmi, the gross sight, that the Yestrovi Ami, your Mishta Shalom, Shalom, the Kachav, Mausova, Mishrilahon, Minadom of the Dark Shalom. Do we have license to be involved to some extent because of Dark Shalom? So, Omalei, Mishta Shalom, Kachav, Mausova, Mishrilahon, Minadom of the Dark Shalom. So, we told them to participate in their festival. So it was of Dr. Shalom, he wanted to allow it, Rav Ami. It's Omalei Rova, but Rova chimed in, but Tonar Rav Chia, Yom Mishta Shalom and Rav Osir, you should stay away from such things. Omar Rav Mono, Lulei Rova, Yom Matir Avodah Yisrochav. If not for Rova, I would have allowed a private practice which is related to idolatry. Avodah Yisrochav Shalom, Uvaruch Shel Chaktu Mehem, Uvaruch Hashem, because of Rova kept me away from them. And the Goyin adds, the Chol Heichad Yikol Ishtamute, when one can gracefully bow out, is Lo Sharina Kedei LaHaknas Lahem. We do not, the Halacha does not give us license to flatter them and to participate. This is based on the Ramban and the Rav. So here we have the two sides of the issue. On one hand, to participate, and even the Shulchan Aruch even gives us license if necessary, to send them a present. But to the extent that we don't have to be direct participants, we should avoid it. That's why the Rambam continues. V'chein v'shaleach d'orim lo'ovid v'chobim b'zman hazeh b'yom sh'yesh lehem simen on yagia lehem d'orim b'chag ahu and efsh. In certain of the non-Jewish practices, if they received a present on their festival, it was considered a heavenly omen of good tidings. So he says, if you're going to send in such a situation, in Epshalom, if it's possible, Yishlach Lomi Be'erav, then send it on Erev Yontif. Be'im Lo, Yishlach Lomi Chag Atzmo, and if you have no choice, then send it on the Chag itself. Now, in today's world, there's two things. Rarely in today's world would it be taken as an omen of a heavenly blessing. Certainly not in this city of New York where we live, is it going to be taken in such a fashion. But nevertheless, we also have the good fortune that by and large we don't interact with our non-Jewish neighbors on the 25th of December. 25th of December, they're involved in their own things. The world of commerce comes to a halt. It's about as quiet as it ever gets. So typically, what's expected, in fact, is that if you're going to give them a gift, that you give it to them not even before Erev Yom Tov. And Tom and Ish, you have about 7 days Tashlum, and then in between, you know, the 25th and the 1st, you know. So Avishal Echad Yom Tov Rishon, you know, has another 7 days. So in our society, we can, to a large extent, readily avoid giving a gift on the holiday itself. And the terms certainly apply, and our time is not taken as a religious time, it's considered a social. So undoubtedly, it's a social thing. It's a time when people express their social good wishes to each other. Yes?
Well, nowadays, they have this new way of arranging things. They say, we're going to make a holiday party, and it's going to include Xmas and Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa and all these things, and they make it on a different time, and you know they expect everybody to come and say happy holidays and this and that.
Well, they basically listen. What they want to it? What's their purpose? There's a business purpose to it. The business purpose is they want to establish harmony between the staff that has to work with each other the whole year. And in businesses, they want to establish a certain element of goodwill in between the people that are working and the administration. Those are the two ends of these happenings today. So the fact is, today it's a lot easier because they never occur on the holiday itself because no one's in business on the day of the holiday. So all of these occur sometime in the month of December, usually in the first 3 weeks of December, all of these happenings. That's when they take place. So that certainly they're not, you don't have to be sameach with them b'yom chagam. To the extent that it's expected in your place of business that you participate to some extent, then you should participate. To the extent that those which it's not necessary, one should avoid it. To know the difference between those two, it takes a great deal of wisdom and a great deal of understanding of the culture of the particular business that you're in, the people that are running it, and what exactly their culture is, and what exactly their expectations are, what's important to them, what's not important to them. So that one needs firsthand to have a very good feeling. So this is the struggle that we have always in Chutzlaret, is how to accommodate the balance between these two. But, you know, on one hand, not being insular, to being part of the team, a team player, and on the other hand, to stay outside it, that we're really not part of it. It's almost lahavdil, and I use that very, very emphatically. You know, the notion that we have in the Medrash is that the Esrog, right, which represents the Talmud Chacham, is together with everyone else, but yet apart. And all the life is togetherness and is separation. And the question is, in all types of associations, how to establish the appropriate balance. So I say emphatically, lahavdil, lahavdil, lahavdil from that. But nevertheless, it's a notion that we often have. There's a necessity of togetherness, a necessity of separation. I wanted to touch just a couple of some of the halachas which very commonly arise at this time of the year. And the first and foremost that we need to know was that the schorah b'davar ha'asur, that those things which are food items, which we may not eat, we may not buy those items either. Even if we don't buy them for our personal use, even if we buy them merely for the purpose of giving as gifts to non-Jews, and we're not, we have no concern whatsoever that they're going to share it with Jewish people, so we're not being machshir on the Jews. We may not buy non-kosher food even to give to non-Jews. The halacha even states if I have non-Jewish employees and I have to feed them lunch, I cannot buy non-kosher food and supply them with that for their meal. There's an Isra of Schoira B'davar Ha'asur, and that's the Raisa, the Rabbanon, and debated exactly what it is. But Asur it is, it's in the Siman of the Shulchan Aruch. So that's first and foremost, is we cannot engage in buying non-kosher for anyone. no matter who they might be. Beyond that, a second consideration is the Stam Yenom is Osir Bahano. Stam Yenom means wine which was not used as part of a religious service. There's very little wine in our society is actually used in a religious service. If you want, you can go down Sunday morning, you know, and join the parishioners, and you'll have wine from all that for use for religious purposes. But wine for religious purposes is few and far between. But wine which is handled and manufactured, or manufactured by non-Jews, is Stam Yenom. Stam Yenom, we may not participate, partake of. Apparently, because it's an extension of the general gzeira, even though the purpose of this gzeira was to avoid chasonos, that we should not come to intermarry with them. And Chazal understood very well the role of drink in social interaction, and they wanted to limit our social interaction with them. Consequently, they prohibited Stam Yenom. But I believe because of the fact that it's associated with the general Yisr of Yayin Shel Avodah Zarah, they went so far as to make an Osir B'Hanotah.
I occasionally get a bottle. I keep it in the desk drawer for a few weeks, and then eventually I throw it out, and like, no one would even think.
Yeah, that's fine. Right. That's exactly fine.
Right.
So if one receives it, one can't even give it away to someone else. It's non-Jewish. To give it directly to them is also hanok, because they'll be thankful to me. If I left it someplace where somebody would just take it and they wouldn't know it's from me, that's fine. But then I have no benefit from it. But to actually give it to someone as a matana, that would not be permissible. Now, the shach in two places interesting. In one place, the shach says that Samena is osur b'hano. In one place, the shach says it's mutter b'hano. So apparently, the halacha of the maisa, pesha advarim between these two is, then if it's Mabokum Hefsid Maruba, so then the halacha is that we allow it. But if it's Hefsid Mu'at, then we'll machmar and we declare it Osir Bahano. So if you happen to receive, you know, some guy goes bankrupt and he owes you money and the receiver sends you a truckload of non kosher wine, so you can put it up for sale to get your money back. But for a bottle or two, not kedai. Yes.
Let's say, I don't know if it gets a gift basket that there's some non kosher wine in there. And so the clean lady comes and says, oh, can I have it? Are you allowed to say, if you say no, it's going to be like, you know, can you say yes, or is that considered hana?
Listen, if it's a question of Ava, like as you're referring to, Ava to me goes beyond Hefsit Maruva. Ava is more than Hefsit Maruva. So, Ava, I would be saying Machan the Shach. In other words, if she knows, for example, that you don't use the non kosher one,
yeah,
is that sophisticated, and she asks you if she can have it for her holiday, and you're going to say no, it's going to arouse resentment, then I believe you should be saying Machan the Shach and give it to her. Because Ava transcends Hefsit Maruva. Yes?
What about? The concept, you get together with a big brother of the party, and there's in addition to wine, there's other alcohol. Is there any kisser in that?
That
comes within the getter of Stam Yenom, because
it's interesting. The question is, do other forms of hard drink fall in the realm of Stam Yenom? And the answer to that question is no. Now, I'm not sure what the reason why they didn't extend it further is. My assumption, perhaps, is that commonly wine was the most common thing that they used in those social settings. Even though beer was common at the time of the Gemara, but in many places the wine was so ubiquitous, it was more available than water. You know, instead of Coca-Cola and water, they drank wine. So that could be is the reason that they limited it to that, or it could be it was limited as an extension perhaps also to the Easter of Yayin Shel Avodah Zarah, or perhaps a combination of those reasons. But perhaps fortunately for us, they did not, you know, ban other types of drink, because our problems would be exacerbated greatly in many, many situations. I want to touch upon a very difficult issue, the issue of Maris Ayin. Now, Maris Ayin means that we should not involve ourselves in a situation where we appear to be in violation of the halacha, even if that's not what we're doing. That the Gemara Avodah Zara puts it in this sense, that if there's a road which goes to a religious shrine, and that's at a dead end at that shrine, all you can do from that road is turn around and come back. There's nothing else on this road. So the halacha is it's also to travel on that road, even if you have some other purpose, whatever it may be. This is Maris Ayin. If in time the Chazon Ish elaborates upon this, as often happens, in a place which is a religious shrine becomes a tourist center, and therefore a commercial establishment develops around it. That's what all of these people going through. It's a good place to do business. So the swifter businessmen start, you know, setting up business establishments to serve the clientele that's coming. So once there's clearly a business community that's established there, that is mutter to go on this road. Because now it is viewed, even though that may be the secondary purpose for going on this road, but there's another known legitimate purpose for going here. So normally we're not supposed to be found inside non-kosher restaurants, with the obvious exception being when there are rest stops along the highways, because there they were established exactly to be rest stops. Part of the price of the franchise is to provide the services to the travelers. So that's clear that they are used very widely for purposes other than as restaurants, and one is allowed to go into them. But the problem of holiday parties which take place in restaurants is a very difficult problem in a non-kosher restaurant. And I am not comfortable with the notion that a person should go into a non-kosher restaurant. It seems to me, even though it is true that they do accommodate Jewish people, and they provide kosher food, they'll bring in kosher food, but it's hard to imagine that the average person, seeing the person going into a non-kosher restaurant, envisions the fact that someone's eating kosher food in this establishment. It just does not sit well with me, that idea. I have been relatively liberal when the parties take place, not in the restaurant themselves, but in party rooms of the restaurant. Because in party rooms of the restaurant, there it's a lot more open, what's going to be brought in, who's going to cater, what the food is going to be, all types of possibilities open up. It's not the classical restaurant itself. So in such situations, I've been relatively liberal in that regard. You know, to allow people to attend. But you have to be very careful, even if they have heter to attend, and even if they order kosher food for you, to make sure that you're allowed to eat. Now, you can sometimes have the situation where you don't have simonim. So how do you know that this is the food that came from the kosher place by the time you come to eat? And a non-Jew does not have halachically standing to settle that issue. So that's one problem. You also have to be careful at holiday parties at times in their willingness to be gracious. People go around and they see that the kosher table looks a little bit sparse. So they start bringing things to some of the other tables at the beginning of the party before the people come in, so that they treat, you know, that these people shouldn't be shifted. They should also get, you know, their due. You know, and this happens. I'm not telling you something that hasn't happened. This has happened. I mean, I, Baruch Hashem, what I do, I'm spared from attending holiday parties. Then I don't have to do, you know, in my life. You know, I'm not necessarily exempt from holiday gift giving. You know, I do have, you know, there's some non-Jews who work for me. There's some that vary rabbinic responsibilities I have to interact with. And it's good to stay on the good side. So, you know, that I'm not spared from in what I do. But going to holiday parties, Baruch Hashem, I'm spared from in my line of work. But I do hear from the people that are out there in the world of business what goes on. So So this, you know, this is what people, the feedback that I get, that sometimes in their graciousness, they'll bring some of the non-kosher food, so you have to have your wits about you. So those are the things, you know, that you have to very, very much, you know, be careful about, even if you've avoided the Maris Ayin issue. I wanted to end, coming back to Hanukkah. I had a conversation this morning, and this conversation drove home to me. The Rebbetzin of the Rangazunt is a descendant, a great great granddaughter of the Nesivos. And the Nesivos, in his Haggadah Pesach, offers a remarkable insight interpretation of the Brocha Shechiyono V'Kimono V'Gyono L'Zman Hazeh, which I have shared in previous times, and it's always been very meaningful to me. We find that the bracha seems to repeat three times the same notion, Shechiyono, Kimono, V'Gyono L'Zman Hazeh. I mean, if you asked me, any one of the three would have been fine. Which what we need all three for, you know, is always puzzling. So the Nesivos and his Haggadah tells us there are three things we have to thank the Rabbeinu Shalom for. One is Shechiyono, as we say today, Am Yisrael Chai. The fact that we're here, that we have survived our difficult history, and we've lived to tell the tale, we're around to want to physically to be here to do the mitzvah. That's Shechiyono. Secondly, what's the kimono? It's the same Rosh Hashanah every day. Chai lo ad, b'kayam lo netzach. The Rabbeinu Shalom lives eternally and kayam lo netzach. What's kayam? Kayam is what the Novi says, Ani Hashem lo yishan yisik. The Rabbeinu Shalom is unchanging. Its principles are always the same. And that's the kimono, that we have the same principles, the same fidelity to the Rabbeinu Shalom's Torah that we always have. And yet, after those two things, we need another bracha from the Rabbeinu Shalom. And the higiyono is that it gives us the practical circumstances which allow us to fulfill the mitzvah. We could be here, or we could want to fulfill the mitzvah, but not that every time and place of Yizayichah to the higiyono, to have the practical means, the practical circumstances to allow us to fulfill this mitzvah. I came to Yeshiva this morning, and the foreman of all the workers that work in the building to keep the building in maintenance is a Russian Jew. His name is Meir. I guess in some way it's getting between 65 and 70, that's what he looks like. Meir is a traditional, he's a traditional Jew, but he's not exactly, you know, from our background. And we talk each morning. He always is by the door, I guess, overseeing security for the building in the morning. And every day when I come to Yeshiva, we exchange, you know, a moment talking Yiddish on my way into the building every day. He's a very pleasant man. So I said to him, you know, Meir, tonight's Hanukkah. And I muse for a moment. And I tell him, Hanukkah is a time that I think back to our childhood. A child likes the Menorah. And then I can remember, you know, as a young child, not necessarily the first time that I lit the menorah, but I remember lighting the menorah as a very young child. Think back to that time in life. The menorah that you had, the candles that you had, your siblings, exactly how it took place, where it took place. It's one of the very special memories of this time of the year. He says to the rabbi, he says, like Americana Guevara. But yeah, I tell him, yeah, I was born in this country. Yeah, but now he was born in the United States. So he says, unfortunately, he said, I did not in my childhood have a Hanukkah menorah. He says, yeah, my grandparents, I'm sure, that they lived a Hanukkah menorah. But for the time I was a young child, so 60 years back, you know, communism had so taken hold that this was much too dangerous a practice to engage in. It wasn't common, you know, for people did not normally light Hanukkah in Russia. And here it struck me, the words of the Nesivos resonated, that not 1,000 years ago, not 50, not 100 years ago, but in our day and age, the people that we rub shoulders with every single day, and they did not merit to be higiyonim, to live under circumstances where they could perform the Rabbanu Shalom's mitzvahs. When I made the bracha tonight, this is what I shared with my family, is Baruch Hashem, is that we live in a time and place that was zoicha to all three, to be shechiyonim, to be himonim, to be higiyonim, and we have to thank the Rabbanu Shalom for that. Is in the schus of the neres of Hanukkah, should be madlik the neres of a neshama, to light a spiritual path for us, that will lead us through the world around us, through all the challenges of Western civilization that really lie at the root of the Hanukkah spirit. I pray the Hanukkah Rabbi Yisai, there are some donuts here for those that wish to participate. If someone will open them up, if any are left, put them up here for the next edition of the Daf Yomi for tomorrow.